Hey everybody, welcome to Morbidology. I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporters, John Sparrow, Lauren Peterson, Leanne Booth, Joe Sheehan, Danielle McDougall, Casey Milstead, Matt Daddy, Britton Rice, Anna Lumley, and Taylor Lewin. The support up on Patreon helps defray the costs of filing Freedom of Information requests, hosting, music licensing, equipment upgrades, and much more. I'm eternally grateful for any support up on Patreon, and in return, you'll get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus each month, ad-free and early release episodes, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. I mentioned it last week, but Morbidology has been selected as a finalist in the True Crime category at the Discover Podcast Awards 2020. If you guys would like to vote for me to win, that would be amazing. I've included the link in the show notes, and it literally takes 10 seconds. As always, thank you for all of the support. Next up is a quick word from my sponsor for this week, and then on with the show. Before we get on with this week's episode of Morbidology, I'd like to mention this week's sponsor, The Mermaid and the Lion. This is a scripted audio drama podcast about two imperfect people working on perfecting their love for one another. I've been binging this podcast over the past 2 weeks, and I cannot recommend it enough. I'm about to play a little snippet, and while you're listening, make sure you subscribe to The Mermaid and the Lion wherever you're listening.
Mermaid and the Lion. Mermaid and the Lion. Mermaid and the Lion.
A Chevy 1500 had just made a left-hand turn, hitting me directly on the driver's side of my door, on my small Dodge Stratus. My car went flying to the right, hitting electrical poles and finally pinning me between the posts of a corner gas station's price sign. I don't know what happened, but I was in a daze. People had started surrounding the car, banging on the windows, asking if I was okay, but I couldn't speak. Are you okay? Then I heard my mom screaming my name through the phone. I could see it on the floor well of the passenger side. I need to talk to her. I went to reach for it, then I felt excruciating pain travel from my neck down my spine. But something told me to keep going because I had to answer her. I grabbed the phone and told her I'd just been hit and my door was smashed in.
Tell me, what do you mean you've been hit?
I was trapped.
By whom?
Now I was really freaking out.
Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. In October of 2012, residents in an upmarket and lavish apartment complex in New York City were disturbed by a deafening scream echoing throughout the hallways. A mother had come home to find her apartment pitch black. In the bathroom, as her eyes adjusted to the light, she saw her bathtub spattered in blood, and out of the corner of her eye, she saw a woman holding a knife. The Krim family consisted of Kevin and Marina and their three children, 2-year-old Leo, 3-year-old Nessie, and 6-year-old Lucia, also known as Lulu. Kevin Krim worked as a CNBC digital media executive, while Marina was a stay-at-home mother who also kept a blog called Life with the Little Krim Kids. Marina's blog depicted their life with photographs and videos of the family. In one entry, Marina wrote fondly about visiting the home of their nanny. Yoselyn Ortega had worked as a nanny for the family for the past 2 years, after being recommended to the family by her sister. She was originally from the Dominican Republic, and in February of 2012, the Krim family visited Yoselyn's home country. In a blog entry, Marina wrote, "We met Yossi's amazing familia, and the Dominican Republic is just a wonderful country." Marina also had a cooking blog and taught art classes to young children. The family lived in a stately late 19th century apartment in New York City, in one of the most idyllic and well sought after neighborhoods, just a block away from Central Park and a couple of blocks away from the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. The neighborhood is the home for many affluent families, and having a nanny was an everyday part of life. The Krim family had moved to New York City from San Francisco around 3 years earlier for Kevin's job. Here, they rescued a greyhound named Babar, which had been used for racing. Both Kevin and Marina were hands-on parents and spent most of their free time with their three children, often walking in Central Park, taking trips to Legoland, and collecting fruit together. Leo was just learning how to walk and had recently developed a bit of an obsession with his new Croc shoes. He loved collecting acorns from the ground. Lulu was a girly girl through and through. She loved art projects, ballet, everything pink, and princesses. Her favorite class in school was art, and she was learning how to speak Spanish. Yoselyn, the nanny, lived in Washington Heights, a working-class neighborhood just north of the Krim family. It was October of 2012 when Kevin left on a business trip. On the 25th of October 2012, Marina took Nessie to a swimming lesson nearby. Leo was in the care of Yoselyn, who was scheduled to pick Lulu up from Public School 87 at 3:20 p.m. and then take her to a dance lesson. Marina and Nessie were supposed to meet Yoselyn, Leo, and Lulu at the dance studio, but when Marina and Nessie arrived, they were nowhere to be seen. Assuming that they had already left, Marina and Nessie headed on to the swimming lesson. That evening, at around 5:34 p.m, Marina came home with Nessie. She was perplexed to find that the apartment was dark. Marina went downstairs to the lobby of the apartment and asked the doorman whether Yoselyn had gone out with the children. The doorman informed Marina that they hadn't left the apartment all afternoon. Puzzled, Marina went back upstairs. As she searched from room to room, she would be met by a scene that no parent should ever be exposed to. As she slowly opened the bathroom door, her eyes were transfixed to the bathtub, which was stained red. As her eyes became adjusted to the dark, she noticed that the lifeless bodies of Leo and Lulu were in the bathtub. In the corner of the room, she saw Yoselyn, armed with a knife. In a matter of seconds, Yoselyn started to stab herself in the neck and wrists before collapsing on the ground. The screams coming from Marina echoed throughout the apartment complex, and a number of neighbours called 911. It was evident that this was no playful scream, but instead, a scream filled with fear and grief.
She's crying out, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? My life is ruined. I have no children.
The doorman and his 10-year-old son also heard the screams and rushed up to the apartment, where they too witnessed the gruesome and heartbreaking scene. When police arrived, Marina was inconsolable in the lobby. She was screaming hysterically and clutching Nessie. their neighbor, Rima Starr, described the scene to the Associated Press.
The mother was holding her like three-year-old baby and just clutching her so tight, like she could hardly breathe, and rocking back and forth and screaming in some kind of hysterical, like, psychotic state.
Kevin rushed home from his business trip and was met by police at the airport. Jocelyn was taken to the hospital for self-inflicted knife wounds and was in critical condition in an induced coma. Investigators announced that they had been unable to question her yet, in part because she was still breathing with the help of a tube. However, they did announce that Jocelyn was the sole suspect in the murders and that her motive and mental state still remained an enigma. According to Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly, however, the initial investigation had yet to reveal anything was amiss in the household before the murders. The brutal murders stunned the entire community and left many parents wondering if they truly knew who was looking after their children. Denise Albert, who lived nearby, spoke with the St. Paul Pioneer Express and said, "For working parents, this is a nightmare. Every mother I know is asking today, how do I go back to work?" As news hit the headlines, a makeshift memorial appeared at the apartment complex. Flowers, stuffed animals, candles, and cards of condolences were piled up on the street, growing with every hour that passed. One read, "Dear Krim family, we weep with you at your horrible loss. There are no words that can express our sadness. We pray for you and your beautiful children." Concerned parents and mournful locals gathered outside and spoke among themselves, expressing shock and grief over what had happened. Michelle Person, a nanny from Jamaica, broke down in tears as she thought of Leo and Lulu. She said, "You just feel like it was the kid that you were taking care of too. It's horrible.
I couldn't sleep, you know. When I went to bed, I was thinking about the parents, and I woke up. So the first thing that I thought was, you know, coming by to, I don't know, to leave the flowers and pray for her, pray for the family so God could give them comfort and peace. Because that's the only thing we can do right now is just pray. It's really sad. I don't know what could drive someone to do this."
While there are tens and thousands of nannies working in New York City, reports of serious violence are extremely rare. When it comes to nannies, there's arguably no other profession wherein the line between family and workplace is so thin. Just 2 years before the murders, New York had passed a law to protect nannies from financial exploitation. It was extremely common for nannies to work 10 or 12-hour shifts for a very low wage. This wasn't the case for Jocelyn, however, who was paid a fair wage and was truly welcomed as part of the Krim family. Cases of children being seriously injured or killed while in childcare is extremely rare. In fact, statistics show that children are more likely to be harmed while with their parents. Statistics also show that it's most often a child's own parent who are responsible for abuse and neglect. 79.4% of child abusers are the parents, and then the most likely offenders were partners of the parents. As Jocelyn was in a coma, people were desperate to find out more. A number of friends and family of Jocelyn divulged that in the weeks leading up to the murders, Jocelyn appeared to be struggling mentally and financially. However, they all said that they couldn't comprehend what had happened or reconcile the woman accused of the murders of two children as the Jocelyn that they knew and loved. Her sister, Celia Ortega, spoke with the New York Post and said that her sister must have snapped, but she didn't understand what had happened to her mind. She said that Jocelyn loved Leo and Lulu and had been part of the family since Leo's birth. According to Celia, her sister had told her that she felt like she was losing her mind lately, and a number of relatives had told her to reach out to a psychologist. Celia had been the one to recommend her sister to the Krim family, and she said that she was racked with grief and said that she would like to give her own life for Leo and Lulu. In fact, a number of neighbours of the Krims had even noticed Jocelyn's demeanour had changed. Typically, Jocelyn would cheerily greet the neighbours by hollering, Hello, neighbor, and God bless you. However, recently, many people had noticed that Yoselin appeared to be extremely quiet and even aloof. They said that she had lost a lot of weight and appeared to look unhealthy, as if she had aged years in just a matter of weeks. According to police, they were unaware of any significant history of psychological problems for Yoselin, but it was still early days and the investigation had only begun. Just the following day, however, a spokesman for the New York Police Department said that there had been financial concerns and that Yoselin had been seeking professional help. As the investigation into a potential motivation was underway, the autopsies of Leo and Lulu were conducted. It showed that Lulu had attempted to defend herself against the attack and had sustained defensive wounds. She had been stabbed in the neck and stomach, while Leo had been stabbed twice in the neck. He had been asleep when the attack began. The two children didn't stand a chance. On the 28th of October, Yoselin woke up from the medically induced coma. While she refused to speak to investigators, she asked about her family and did not mention her two victims. However, it was soon revealed that Yoselin had given some more information regarding the murders to investigators. She had told them that Marina and Kevin had arranged for her to do some housework, which would earn her some extra money. However, that seemingly didn't set well with Yoselin, who said she was unhappy about doing anything beyond caring for the two children she murdered. She told investigators that the additional work interfered with her doctor's appointments and that she didn't enjoy doing any housework. Furthermore, her work had been suffering and she said that Kevin and Marina told her that she needed to improve or she could potentially lose her job. On the 2nd of November, Yoselin was charged with 2 counts each of murder in the first and second degree. Following the charges, it was further revealed that Yoselin and Marina had a massive argument just the day before the murders. Yoselin told investigators that when she left the apartment at the end of the day, Marina ignored her when she said goodbye, and this had made her very angry. Yoselin had told investigators that she and Marina had a number of disagreements recently over the care of Leo and Lulu. Marina felt as though Yoselin needed to be more involved with the children and was giving them too much junk food. According to investigators, Yoselin had shown no remorse or sadness over the murders. They said that the more they spoke with Yoselin, the more they came to discover that the situation within the household was not as harmonious as originally believed. The interviews Yoselin had given investigators painted a grim picture of her mindset leading up to the murders. On the 5th of November, the Krim family gathered with hundreds of mourners to commemorate the lives of Leo and Lulu at Avery Fisher Hall. In a statement, Kevin said that they wanted to celebrate the beautiful lives of Lulu and Leo. During the 90-minute service, their music teacher played the song Daughter by Ludon Wainwright and ended the service with the song Go On by Jack Johnson. In the wake of the murders, the Krim family created the Lulu and Leo Fund, which would help fund science and art classes. Kevin and Marina recounted fond memories of their children, but when Kevin got to the part where they were gone, he couldn't contain his tears. They said that during the memorial, it was important for Leo and Lulu to be remembered as the sweet, creative, and fun-loving children that they were. Days after the memorial, investigators said that they believed that money issues may have been a problem for Yoselin after she decided to move her 17-year-old son, Jesus, to New York from the Dominican Republic. They said that she wanted to give her son a better life and felt as though the $18 per hour that she earned from the Krim family wasn't going to cover private school, which was where she wanted to send him to. Yoselin and Jesus shared an apartment, but the landlord wanted the apartment back, so Yoselin and Jesus had to move in with relatives. To make ends meet, Yoselin sold makeup and cheap jewellery. David and Marina had offered to pay Yoselin an extra $90 a week, which would have earned her an extra $4,500 per year. Jocelyn was earning over $32,000 annually. According to Glassdoor, the average salary for a nanny in New York City in 2020 is $33,000. Towards the end of November, Jocelyn pleaded not guilty to the murders from her hospital bed. Jocelyn asked for special treatment from the judge and requested that the press be barred from the arraignment. Her lawyer, Valerie Van Leer Greenberg, said that Jocelyn was too pathetic to be seen by the public. The judge ultimately turned down her request, and a reporter was allowed to be in the room as Jocelyn pleaded not guilty. The judge said that in allowing the proceeding to be covered by the media, he recognized that sometimes it became uncomfortable, but said that that is the cost when it comes to civil liberties. During the hearing, Jocelyn was alert, but she did not speak. Her lawyer entered a not guilty plea on her behalf. She also said that Jocelyn was profoundly medically impaired and in need of medical assistance. She was ordered to undergo a psychiatric evaluation to determine whether she was fit to stand trial. Following the murders, Marina, Kevin, and Nessie left New York City to stay with relatives in California. In early January, they shared their heartache with the world. Posting online on Nessie's birthday, they wrote that their daughter saves them every single day. They revealed that they had found a gallery in Los Angeles which displayed a mural by Leo Politti, who was Leo's favourite children's author. Marina wrote, "Lulu and Leo were there in spirit with us for our Christmas Eve adventure." In mid-January, the family moved back to their apartment in New York City. In February, it was announced that doctors needed more time to examine Jocelyn. In April, it was determined that Jocelyn was fit to stand trial. She had been examined by two mental health professionals who both found that she could assist in her defense in a meaningful way and that she was mentally fit to proceed to trial. However, shortly thereafter, it was announced that Jocelyn and her defense team would be challenging the finding. In May, Marina and Kevin announced that they were expecting a baby boy and he was scheduled to be born in the fall. The family had lots of support in the months following the murders, and they said that while they were of course still filled with emotions and grief, they were also now filled with hope. The following month, Jocelyn made quite a startling claim in a jailhouse interview with the Daily News. She claimed that she did not kill Leo and Lulu and instead claimed that somebody else did. It was the first time that Jocelyn had spoken publicly since the murders. When she was asked about the murder charges, she softly replied, "Those are all lies." She did not offer up an alternative suspect, and when asked if she loved Leo and Lulu, she said, "My lawyer told me not to talk. I'm not supposed to say anything." In late June, Dr. Karen Rosenbaum said in court that her psychiatric evaluation of Jocelyn found that she suffered from depression and brain damage and was too psychotic to stand trial. The doctor was there alongside Jocelyn and her defense to challenge the government-ordered evaluation that had found Jocelyn fit to stand trial. Dr. Rosenbaum read aloud from an interview she had with Jocelyn, wherein she heard voices while in jail telling her to hurt people. The doctor said that in addition to examining Jocelyn, she had studied 8,000 pages documenting Jocelyn's medical and psychiatric state. She said that in the weeks following the murders, Jocelyn had imagined that it was the year 2000 and was unable to count backwards from 20. According to the doctor, Jocelyn had improved somewhat since then, but still suffered from psychosis, compounded by depression, as well as brain damage caused by her self-inflicted wounds. It was revealed that Jocelyn had cut her dura, which had allowed potentially destructive air into the normally sealed brain cavity, while a slice to the interior side of the carotid artery reduced the flow of oxygenated blood. According to Dr. Rosenbaum, Jocelyn had a mental crisis in 2008 in the Dominican Republic. She had become so uncommunicative and withdrawn that her family had worried for her sanity. Then in 2012, she demonstrated signs of delusional thinking in the United States. She had forbidden her 17-year-old son to play baseball or listen to music, and forced him to hide with her under a bed whenever a dog barked. She had also said that 3 days before the murders, Jocelyn had gone berserk in the kitchen of the apartment she shared with her sister, throwing pots and pans around her, but later she could not remember what had happened. This peculiar behaviour had continued the day of the murders. That morning, Jocelyn had knocked on a neighbour's door and asked to come in and make breakfast. She then pleaded with a teenage girl in the apartment to come out with her and sit with her because she was too afraid to be alone. Contrary to her insanity claim, Jocelyn had earlier spoken with the Daily News and made it clear she had a firm grasp of her legal situation. Assistant District Attorney Stuart Silberg asked Dr. Rosenbaum if Jocelyn had used rational thinking when explaining to the reporter that she was innocent, that somebody else committed the murder, and that she understood her legal situation, to which the doctor replied, "I don't really know how it went down." He stated that the mental fitness requirement was to be able to listen, understand, and make your own choices, and Dr. Rosenbaum agreed. That was the standard, and admitted that Jocelyn's statements showed cooperation with her lawyer. Another forensic psychiatrist testified to the opposite. According to Dr. Miles Schneider of Bellevue Hospital, he believed that Jocelyn was fit to stand trial and may have been faking psychotic symptoms. He said that malingerers can always try to fake out doctors, but they forget that nurses are always around and documenting progress. He said that sometimes they don't feel they have to present the symptoms the way they do when they're around a doctor. He said that Jocelyn continued to say she heard voices, but had never been reported as responding to internal stimuli. Dr. Ankur Saria also testified that the damage from Jocelyn's injuries was not substantial enough to interfere with her ability to stand trial for murder. A number of phone calls were also presented by the prosecution, which had been recorded in jail. They showed that Jocelyn had been making reasoned statements during conversations with her family. She sounded completely lucid and was competent enough to understand her situation. Ultimately, the judge ruled that Jocelyn was mentally fit for trial. Shortly after the determination that Jocelyn would be standing trial, Marina gave birth to a healthy baby boy, who they named Felix Harrison. Shortly after the birth, they appeared at a fundraiser for the non-profit, the Lulu and Leo Fund, where they said that they think of and miss their children every single day. Kevin said, "We are just heartbroken, but they inspire us every single day as well. Their lives give us a purpose." In early November, an evidentiary hearing was held in Manhattan Supreme Court. During the hearing, it was revealed that Jocelyn's lawyer had shown her graphic photographs of Leo and Lulu, and she had responded with, "Who did that to them?" According to her lawyer, she had no memory of the incident. Shortly thereafter, motions were filed which gave further insight into Jocelyn's memory of the murders. It was revealed that when she gained consciousness after stabbing herself, she said, "Oh my God, I'm sorry for what I've done. Relieve me of my misery." Furthermore, Jocelyn had told investigators that she had hurt the children because she was having money problems and was angry at their parents. She said that her schedule always changed and she had been asked to clean the house for extra money, which she didn't want to do. According to the documents, Jocelyn had said that she killed Leo and Lulu using two knives and said that Lulu had attempted to fight back. In October of 2015, Marina and Kevin announced that they were expecting a baby boy who was due in January. There was no update in the case until April of 2016, when it was revealed that Judge Gregory Caro had made a plea offer for Jocelyn. He offered Jocelyn 30 years to life in prison, which was the minimum sentence, in exchange for her guilty plea. Jocelyn, however, turned down the deal. The offer had been made over the objection of prosecutors who felt as though the only appropriate sentence for such a horrible crime was life in prison without parole. It was quite a strange offer considering the fact that Marina and Kevin were going to testify against Yoselin during trial, and she would very likely be found guilty. In February of 2018, it was revealed that jury selection for the murder trial had begun. Up until now, there had been lengthy pre-trial hearings, but very little had come out in regards to Yoselin's medical history. Her lawyers had revealed pretty much nothing, and the results of any psychiatric examinations had remained under seal. New York has a very high bar for insanity defences. For Yoselin's lawyers to win an acquittal, they must prove that Yoselin did not know right from wrong or did not fully comprehend the consequences of her actions. Proving that a defendant is not guilty by reason of insanity can certainly be a tricky judgment for the jury. Somebody can be mentally ill but can still have a moral understanding of what they are doing and know that it is wrong. The trial began on the 1st of March 2018. During opening statements, prosecutor Courtney Groves described to the jury how Yoselin had brutally butchered Leo and Lulu. She went on to detail how there was overwhelming evidence that she had planned the murders and executed them at a time where she knew that she would not be interrupted.
Marina Krim opened the bathroom door and saw the bloodied, lifeless bodies of her 6-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son stacked in the bathtub, their eyes open, covered in blood, staring ahead. These are the undisputed facts in this case. The defendant intentionally murdered Lulu and Leo Krim on October 25th, 2012. That she knew what she was doing when she killed them, and that she knew that killing them was wrong.
The prosecution stated that it would probably never truly be understood why Yoselin had killed the children, and suggested that she may have been stressed over her son coming to the United States, or the loss of her apartment. Two things which may have boiled over with the resentment for the Krims. She told the jury how Lulu had fought back and had sustained 30 stab wounds, while Leo had sustained 5. She revealed for the first time that they had been so severely stabbed that at first it appeared as though they had both been decapitated. Assistant District Attorney Courtney Grove said there was no way to save them. The devastation the defendant had inflicted on their little bodies was too much. The defense, on the other hand, made it abundantly clear that they would be presenting a mental health defense. Yoselin's lawyer, Valerie Van Leer Greenberg, told the jury during her opening statements that Yoselin had acted in a moment of madness.
The evidence will show that she has a corroborated history of hearing voices and dissociating from reality since the age of 16.
She stated that Yoselin suffered from chronic mental illness and had heard voices since he was 16 years old. She further stated that Yoselin had suffered from depressive disorders, psychotic thinking, and hallucinations that had gone largely untreated. She said that Yoselin was guarded in her symptoms and had been reluctant to seek help. Turning to the jury, she said, "I will ask you to determine at the end of this case whether or not these acts were driven by my client's acute psychotic state." The first person to testify for the prosecution was Marina. The anguish on her face was evident, and the heartache in her voice was audible. When she took to the stand, she glared at Yoselin and said, "I need to take a good look at you. You are a liar. You are disgusting." Marina took the jury through the relationship the family had with Yoselin. While they had come from opposing worlds, they had gotten along quite well at the beginning. She described how she had hired Yoselin after Yoselin's sister gave her a glowing recommendation. According to her sister, Celia, Yoselin was an experienced nanny. This turned out to be untrue. However, Yoselin had provided a phony reference, which was a childless relative who vouched for Yoselin in an emailed letter giving a glowing review. In fact, Yoselin had never worked as a nanny. Yoselin requested $18 an hour, and the Krim family were more than happy to oblige. Marina had stopped working as a kindergarten teacher to raise her children, and Kevin's salary was more than enough to give them a comfortable life. It was after the birth of Leo that they decided to hire a nanny, who could help ferrying the children to ballet classes, swimming classes, art classes, and nursery, all of which were typical of families living in upper-middle-class Manhattan. At first, she described how Jocelyn was perfect for the job. She always arrived on time, was respectful to the family, and never asked for a raise. The Crims had even paid for Jocelyn to vacation in the Dominican Republic, where her family lived, and had spent time there with her. In the 2.5-year employment, Marina remembered only one dispute. She told the jury that she wanted to help Jocelyn with her money issues, so suggested she do a couple extra hours of housework for one of her friends. However, she said that Jocelyn behaved improperly with the friend. She said that she had then asked her to do some housework in their house for extra cash. The courtroom fell silent as Marina took the jury through the grim discovery. She said that the apartment was eerily silent as she opened up the front door. All of the lights were turned off except for the glow of the bathroom light. She said, "It's like a horror movie. I go down, I walk down the hall, and I see the light on under the back of the door. And I'm like, oh God, it's so quiet in here. Oh God, why is it so quiet?" Marina described how after opening the door, she first saw Lulu. She said that she knew instantly that she was dead, because her eyes were fixed. As a tear rolled down her cheek, Marina said, "And I look next to her, and I see Leo, and he has blood on him. Blood all over Lulu's little dress." She said that Jocelyn then started stabbing herself in the neck. Marina grabbed Nessie and ran out of the apartment as the doorman called 911. In the lobby, she described how she screamed and wailed and banged her head as hard as possible on the marble pillars, hoping that she was in a nightmare. She said that deep down, she knew it wasn't a nightmare, and she was never going to see her two children again. She said that a sheet was placed over her head as the bodies of her two children were removed from the bathroom. She said that from underneath the sheet, she saw them being rolled out. Before stepping down from the witness stand for a break, Marina shouted at Jocelyn, "You're gross. You're disgusting." Later, Marina told the jury about an incident. Shortly before the murders, Marina found out she was pregnant. When she told Jocelyn, she gave her a massive hug and said how happy she was. However, Marina sadly had a miscarriage, and when she told Jocelyn, she said that Jocelyn appeared to be mad at her over the miscarriage. Marina then shouted, "She's a narcissist. It's all about money. It's all about money." Marina's testimony was absolutely crushing. There was barely a dry eye in the courtroom as she relived the horror. Jocelyn, on the other hand, showed no semblance of emotion. She just stared straight ahead, stone-faced. Detective Brian Glacken of the NYPD's Emergency Service Unit was next to testify. He said that by the time he arrived on the scene, Leo and Lulu were already dead. He described them as being extremely pale and covered in blood. The jury recoiled in horror as he said, "When I turned his neck to check for a pulse, I saw the child was partially decapitated. When I went to check the pulse of the girl, it was basically the same thing. Her injury was straight down to the spine." Paramedic Kevin Orr next told the jury that the crime scene was the most horrendous scene he had ever seen in his 27-year career as a paramedic. The testimony was followed by graphic photographs showing the lifeless and bloodied bodies of Leo and Lulu. One juror started to cry while another put his head down and stared into his hands. More photographs depicting the crime scene were shown, including a picture of the blood-spattered bathroom. There were blood smears across the wall, floor, and toilet, while the bottom of the bathtub was entirely red. An 11-inch knife was in the sink, while a 13-inch knife wrapped in a red and white towel sat on top of a toy refrigerator. Jocelyn refused to look at the photographs. Therapist Thomas Caffrey testified that he had seen Jocelyn 3 days before the murders. He said that she had anxiety and depression, but had no suicidal or homicidal thoughts. He told the jury that Jocelyn had been obsessing about her teenage son. As he testified, Jocelyn seemingly disputed what he was saying. She turned to her lawyer and said, "No, no." He testified that Jocelyn had never complained to him about her work life and instead seemed preoccupied with what was going to happen with her son. She had complained about money worries, but said that it was relative to her son moving over to the United States. Sergeant Yoel Hidalgo's testimony was to follow. Sergeant Hidalgo had spoken to Jocelyn from the hospital bed, and essentially, she had told him that she killed the children because she was overworked. He said that Jocelyn had griped that she had to do everything and take care of the kids. Jocelyn had only wanted to take care of the children and hadn't wanted to do any housework, despite the fact she had told the Crims she would be willing to do housework for extra cash. It wasn't like she wasn't being paid for the work she was doing. They had offered her an extra $100 a week for 5 hours of cleaning. From the hospital bed, after just killing 2 children, Jocelyn complained about the housework because she did not like cleaning products that the Crims had purchased. She complained about an injury she had sustained to her pinky finger, which had been caused by bleach. Another officer, Detective Francis Brennan, next took the jury through the moment he arrived at the crime scene. He described finding Jocelyn on the bathroom floor. He said that she was bleeding from the neck and her eyes were closed. As he testified, Jocelyn began laughing and muttering to herself. He said that at the hospital that night, Leo and Lulu's bodies were put on a gurney and covered with a white sheet, but he could still see the extent of the injuries. The jury would next hear testimony from Kevin Crim, who took them through the harrowing moment he learned of their murders, just after his plane had landed at New York's Kennedy Airport. He said that when he landed, he turned his phone off airplane mode and was flooded with text messages. When he realized what had happened, he crumbled to the ground, referring to the discovery that his children were dead as the worst thing imaginable. He was met at the airport by police and was driven to hospital, where he described kissing his children goodbye as they lay dead on stainless steel tables. He said, "Lulu and Leo were lying on hospital tables, sheets up to their chins. They looked beautiful and strange. They had lost a lot of blood, so they were blue. But they still had this perfect skin, the long eyelashes. They had this sandy brown hair. You could see that they tried really hard to wash the blood out, but it still had kind of an auburn tint to it that I remember to this day. I got down on my knees and I said, 'I'm sorry.' I said, 'I love you,' and kissed them goodbye." His testimony brought tears to much of the jury and those seated in the courtroom. He told the jury that he and Marina had really tried to help Jocelyn. They knew that she was in financial difficulty and had tried to help out as much as possible, offering her more work for more money. They had additionally paid for her to go back to see her family and had employed her son for odd jobs, including walking the dog. On occasion, they had even hired her sister for odd jobs and had recommended her to their friends who needed a nanny for a month. He said that he noticed nothing in her behaviour which could have predicted what was going to happen. One of the most distressing moments of the trial came when the medical examiner detailed the extensive knife wounds that Jocelyn had inflicted on the children. Forensic pathologist Susan Elay showed the jury diagrams of where each wound was found. First of all, she spoke about Lulu's 30 knife wounds. She had been stabbed and slashed on the head, neck, torso, arms and hands. She testified that the extensive injuries to her arms and hands showed that she had put up a desperate fight to get away. She said, "Lulu Crim had her hands up at some point while she was being stabbed. In some way, they got between the knife and her body during the course of violence." She next testified that Leo may not have seen his attacker as he was stabbed 5 times. Jocelyn had then placed them in the bathtub to bleed to death. The first time that Jocelyn showed any semblance of emotion during the trial was when the topic turned to her own sadness. She started to cry when a hospital psychiatrist that had been hired by the defense discussed her complaints about life during an interview he conducted with her around a month after the murders. Psychiatrist Mark Dubin said, "She reports that she has been sad most of the day, crying, upset, that she has been unable to see her family. She complains that she is unable to sleep in the hospital and that she hears voices through the day, but especially at night, saying, 'We are going to get you,' and she worries that they are going to cut her throat." The defense also called on Jocelyn's sister, Miladys Garcia, to testify. She told the jury that in the hours leading up to the murders, she had spoken with her sister on the phone. She said that she exhibited strange behavior and it sounded like she was speaking to a demon. She said she had become something evil. She said that she had urged her sister to get help from a psychiatrist or a priest, adding that her sister abruptly ended the phone call after mentioning that she was hearing voices from a black man. Miladys also said that Marina and Kevin were to blame for not noticing a change in Jocelyn's demeanor. Her testimony was followed by testimony from Jocelyn's son, Jesus, who referred to the murders as an accident. His testimony was quickly interrupted by Assistant District Attorney Silberg, who stated, "I'm sorry, did you just say the accident?" He quickly corrected himself and instead referred to the murders as what happened. The defense also called on another nanny, Chelsea Andrews, to testify. She said that the day before the murders, Jocelyn had complained about too much work and not enough money. According to Chelsea, Jocelyn had been acting strange and she decided against scheduling a play date with her because she didn't like the way she looked. A friend of Jocelyn, Francisca Cornell, next said that Jocelyn had looked unwell in October of 2012. She described her friend as having dark circles underneath her eyes and looking sickly. She said that Jocelyn had not been sleeping well and that she didn't feel good at the job she was doing. Midway through the trial, Dr. Karen Rosenbaum testified. She told the jury that in the weeks after the murders, Jocelyn had told her that she was taking commands from Satan when she committed the murder. Apparently, Jocelyn had told the doctor that she was starting to feel the devil overtaking her, and the evil presence was getting stronger in the weeks leading up to the murder. According to Dr. Rosenbaum, Jocelyn did not know what she was doing when she murdered Leo and Lulu. Instead, she suggested that Jocelyn was in a disassociative state during the murders. She argued that there was no other explanation besides insanity. She said, "She loved the children. She had always talked about loving the children. There was no reason why she would want to hurt anybody other than the psychotic delusions that she was experiencing." Under cross-examination, Dr. Rosenbaum admitted that she based her findings largely on Jocelyn's self-reporting of her symptoms during their interviews. Prosecutor Silberg revealed that just the day before the murders, Jocelyn had gotten her affairs in order and had left family heirlooms to her son and her important records to her sister, all signs that the murders were premeditated. When questioned about this, Dr. Rosenbaum said she still believed that Jocelyn was psychotic. It would soon be revealed that Jocelyn may have damned herself. Following the doctor's testimony, the jury were shown a video of Jocelyn repeatedly admitting to a prosecution expert that the commands from the devil had nothing to do with the murders. The footage severely undercut the defense's explanation of the murders. Psychologist Ali Kadavi testified that Jocelyn exhibited intent, which is the legal standard for sanity, in the bathroom after she murdered Leo and Lulu. He explained to the jury that after plunging the knife into her own neck, Jocelyn had tried to save herself by pressing a towel against the wound to staunch the blood. He stated that this clearly showed intent by trying to save her own life. During closing arguments, Prosecutor Silberg said that Jocelyn knew exactly what she was doing when she killed Lulu and Leo.
Every stab, every slash, each one had a purpose. And that purpose was to end the lives of those children.
He went on to say that the murders were premeditated and deliberate, and that Jocelyn was fully aware of the consequences of her actions. He reminded the jury that Lulu had fought for her life, but she didn't stand a chance, because Jocelyn was determined to end her life. The only verdict for a crime like this was guilty of first-degree murder, he argued. During the defense's closing arguments, attorney Van Leer Greenberg repeated that Jocelyn was mentally ill and that she had experienced hallucinations of the devil. Turning to the jury, she said, "She who is fighting demons could not see that she did not become a demon." She stated that Jocelyn should be found not guilty by reason of insanity. On the second day of deliberations, the jury reached a verdict.
"You find the defendant, Jocelyn Ortega, guilty as to count one, murder in the first degree, guilty as to count two, murder in the first degree, guilty as to count three, murder in the second degree, and guilty as to count four, murder in the second degree."
They rejected Jocelyn's insanity defense and found her guilty on two counts of first-degree murder, as well as two counts of second-degree murder. Kevin broke down in tears upon hearing the verdict and mouthed thank you to the jury. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance also thanked the jury for their diligence throughout what he described as an incredibly difficult and heartbreaking trial. He said, "My heart continues to go out to Kevin and Marina Krim and the entire Krim family. As a father of two myself, I can't begin to imagine the pain they felt and continue to feel." Jocelyn cried as she was led from the courtroom. She had shown no remorse or no emotion for what she had done. The only time she reacted was when the testimony was regarding herself. The following month, the sentencing phase was held. Jocelyn attempted to get leniency. She said, "I'm very sorry, but I hope that no one goes through what I have gone through. I ask for a great deal of forgiveness. To God, to Marina, to Kevin." Marina and Kevin also had the opportunity to speak. Marina said that Jocelyn had tried to destroy her family, but failed. She said that Jocelyn had shown no genuine remorse and said that nobody in her family had apologized for what Jocelyn had done. She referred to the family as an entire family of bad and unethical people. It was her sister, after all, that had approached Marina and claimed that Jocelyn was an experienced nanny.
"Patiently and with great determination, we rebuilt our lives. My family and I, we create and build. The defendant may think she destroyed Lulu and Leo, but she is a failure in this too. Lulu and Leo are powerful forces. They are two stars now that will always lead us forward. Thank you."
Kevin echoed her sentiments, but he dedicated his statement to the memories of Leo and Lulu.
"The defendant knows nothing of responsibility or remorse. She should also know nothing of hope. The defendant is an evil and utterly dangerous narcissist and a complete failure. It is right that she should live and rot and die in a concrete and metal cage, like the ugly, dark shadow of Lulu and Leo's bright, shining lights. And more importantly, it is right that she will go from being hated by the world to being forgotten by the world before she's even dead. While Lulu and Leo's siblings and legions of family and friends, even friends who never knew them, will never forget their inspiring legacies."
Jocelyn was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance said, "Leo and Lulu will never live the lives that laid ahead of them. And now their remorseless killer will live the rest of her life in prison." In the aftermath of the trial, Marina and Kevin backed a new law which would make it a crime to provide fake references for nannies or babysitters. The bill became known as Lulu and Leo's Law, and in late June of 2018, the law passed. The purpose of the law was to protect children from suffering the same fate as Leo and Lulu. Powered by the Lulu and Leo Fund, Marina and Kevin set up Choose Creativity, which is an initiative that empowers children and adults through a curriculum to engage with the 10 principles of creativity to build resilience, creative confidence, and social-emotional skills.
We feel like this community, all of you, have been with us all along through this whole experience. Even if you never met Lulu and Leo, you feel like you know them, you love them, and you're inspired by them like we are.
So a lot of people have been asking us how they can help, how they can support us during this really horrible time. And we thought about it, and we realized that we're going to handle this the way we've handled everything. We're going to focus on the positive and the goodness that's come out of all this. When you hear about us on the news or we come up in conversation, we want you to tell people about the Lulu and Leo Fund and the Choose Creativity Initiative and the 10 Principles of Creativity. This is the legacy of Lulu and Leo, and this is what matters.
The murders of Leo and Lulu Krim truly resonated with the suppressed anxiety and even guilt that many parents feel when trusting a nanny to care for their child. Her act became the ultimate nightmare for affluent parents across the nation. When Yoselyn Ortega snuffed out the lives of Leo and Lulu Krim, she destroyed not one, but two families, leaving her own son without a mother. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said it at the start of this episode, but once again, a massive thank you to all of my Patreon supporters. I am eternally grateful for all of the support, but I'm also grateful for anybody that has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, recommended an episode to a friend, followed me on social media, all of that good stuff. I am eternally grateful. Thank you. If you'd like to join me on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free episodes, early release episodes, polls, true crime articles, and you can also request a case for me to cover on Morbidology. Could I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribe. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Trace Evidence. Till next time, take care of yourself, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hey, this is Stephen Pacheco, the host of Trace Evidence, a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. Each week, I explore a different unsolved case and take a deep dive into the victim, the events leading up to the crime, every fact we know, every question we're left with, and then a breakdown of the most popular theories revolving around that case. Each Monday, a new episode comes out, and there are more than 80 episodes of mysterious and fascinating cases to catch up on. Some you've heard, and many that you haven't. If you're drawn to deep examinations of some of the most mysterious cases, give Trace Evidence a listen. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcatchers. Visit trace-evidence.com for more information, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.